Hi, I'm Max Bergman.
And I'm Donatien Ruiz.
And this is The Europhile, a podcast where we look at Europe through a Washington lens.
Welcome to another episode of The Europhile. Today, we'll discuss the recent European Council meeting and the implications for Ukraine and European defense. Then we'll briefly discuss some developments in Eastern Europe, including Slovakia's presidential election, the first round, and the latest turmoil in negotiations to form a new Bulgarian government. Finally, we'll turn to a conversation with Jeff Rathke, president of the American-German Institute, to discuss the latest developments in German politics. We hope you enjoyed the show. All right, Max, there was a European Council summit last week on March 20th, 21st. Some important developments came out of that on European defense. Talk to us about it.
Yeah, some important developments, although I have to say generally fairly underwhelming. And I think that sort of is the trend line of what we talked about in the previous episode of kind of a month after the Munich Security Conference, there's, you know, Macron held a meeting in Paris. They were supposed to launch kind of Europeans getting together, getting their act together on defense to potentially fill the gap that would be left by the United States. And we've seen some action, but it's frankly all pretty minimal. So the big development here was that the European Investment Bank will potentially agree to start providing financing for defense. And that's not nothing. That's good. The other big development, and something we talked about on our sister podcast, Russian Roulette, check it out, give it five stars, was that the EU looks like it's now in favor of using the profits from frozen Russian assets. So the frozen Russian assets of the central bank are largely stuck in this Belgian institution called Euroclear, more than 200 billion euros. The EU could seize that money. That does come with some downside repercussions, as we talk about on Russian Roulette. But that money is also generating interest and profit, and the Russians aren't entitled to that funding. So that money will potentially be seized. Now we'll figure out, the EU has to figure out how it will actually do that in a legal way. You know, that throws a few more billion at the Ukrainians. I think it's roughly 3 billion a year potentially that could be used. But the big, I think, disappointment coming out of this conference, and something that I've long advocated for, our program has put out a number of pieces, including a big report I did with Otto Svensson, producer of this podcast, calling for the EU to borrow, to issue euro bonds for defense. Now, this proposal is also one that's been advocated by Kaja Kallas, the Estonian prime minister. The Finns now seem to be on board. So this sort of frugal opposition to the EU ever borrowing again is cracking. The French are obviously highly in favor, but are kind of being smart about it and not being, you know, front and center and trying to make this sort of a French initiative. But it met with direct opposition from Mark Rutte, who I think at the European Council sort of started off and said the Dutch are against it, and quote, because it will lead to a shift in power to Brussels. God forbid that, you know, that The Hague not, you know, have complete control over defense and foreign policy. What would European security do if that would be the case?
From the person who is in the lead for next Secretary General of NATO.
Right. And I think in some ways that strikes me as something maybe we'll talk about, but I think there's some potential there to overcome that. But the main opposition is Berlin, right? Berlin is opposed. And what Germany is saying right now is that everyone should just do what Germany's doing, which is giving a lot of stuff to Ukraine and spending a lot of money to support Ukraine. That's great. But you know what? The French budget deficit just came back and it's 5.6%. So that's quite high. So how does France then spend to support Ukraine out of its national budget? Spain isn't going to do that. I mean, it's just not going to do that. And then what we have from Germany is opposing providing more funding to the EU. So Germany has essentially opposed the European peace facility being increased. They announced an increase of 5 billion, but it's basically a mirage where the Germans said that they're not going to contribute because they're doing so much at a national level. And now Germany is opposing Eurobonds. And so what you have here is a situation where European countries don't have the fiscal space to support Ukraine at a bilateral way. only really Germany and maybe a few of the Northern European countries do. And Germany's opposing giving more to the EU level and opposed to borrowing. And part of the reason they're opposed to providing more to the EU level is because now they have this ridiculous budget constitutional break that we've talked about. So they're stuck from a budget perspective. Really, the only way forward here is Eurobonds. Mm-hmm. Let's be clear on what is needed. Right now, in Europe, Europeans are having the wrong conversation. They are fighting about the tourist missile and other things. And I'm not saying that's not important. But in the US, we are actually having the right fight, which is that we are debating allocating $60 billion to Ukraine. That would essentially be spent in like 9 months. And that is what you need to fight a conventional war. You need tens of billions of dollars, if not hundreds of billions of dollars a year to fight this war. And the Europeans have given away all their equipment, so they have nothing left to give. They need to spend money. They need to ramp up production. They need to throw money at this problem. They need to conjure 100 billion euros a year, basically, to replace potentially what would be left if the United States doesn't step up.
And industry has told them, we need the safety of the contracts, of the future contracts, to really ramp up production. So can you guarantee this?
And no, and industry is super annoying because like they're not like a normal private sector company where it's like, oh, demand's super high, we're going to meet it. No, industry is like, well, we only sell to governments, so they're very cautious about ramping up production. So you have to throw money at them. You just, there's literally no other solution here but for Europe to throw a lot of money at its industry. And even if the United States provides the funding for this year, well, what about 2025? And Europeans now all expect Trump to win. Well, if you're going to ramp up for 2025 and support Ukraine, if the US pulls back, you have to make that decision right now. And Eurobonds the EU could instantly conjure 100 billion euros. They can literally do this, and they've done it in the past for the next generation EU in response to COVID. And unlike the next gen EU, which, you know, for the Northern Europeans, and I'm looking at Otto across the room, who's from Denmark, see, so, you know, they're giving money to those, you know, poor indebted Southerners. This would actually be money that the EU would conjure, and it would go to European defense industries. And who are the big European defense, you know, countries, who are the big countries that have European defense industries? Well, Germany, France, Sweden. We are not talking about sort of like throwing money at those like needless Southerners to play into the stereotypes of the Northern Europeans. This would actually be money going into German factories, in French factories, and the French get that. But my God, this would be a huge economic stimulus potentially for Germany. It is actually what is needed for Ukraine. And it boggles my mind that you have essentially what I would describe as an ideological opposition. Because what is Rutte's comment here? It would, God forbid, give more power to Brussels. And it would. Brussels would have, the commission would have to decide where it's going to put this money. But who cares? Like, we're talking about like Ukraine fighting Russia.
Of course.
So what do you care about?
They care about the long-term implications of a decision like this. I completely agree, to be clear, that the imminent threat should take precedence here. I think it's also some of these governments are dealing with political incentives that go the other way around, which is really, let's control exactly how much keeps going to Brussels because we don't want deeper EU integration. Some of these countries might also be looking at the traditional argument of like, we don't want more defense to exist at the EU level because NATO, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not saying it makes rational sense, especially when you talk about the economic side. Unfortunately, this, especially in an election year, these are the incentives that they're dealing with. And that's clearly what we see in this summit.
Yeah. Well, let me talk about maybe the country that could make this happen, the United States. And this is what I find sort of frustrating about the current US policy is that, you know, if the EU tomorrow announced that it was going to borrow 100 billion euros, the Biden administration would not be opposed to it. You might have some stray voltage with the Pentagon, State Department being like, well, we have some concerns about whether U.S. companies are going to be included. But the Biden administration itself would be, okay, yeah, fine, that good stuff. And I think they would actually give it a good thumbs up. But it's not going to happen unless the Biden administration comes in and says, actively, you should do this. And German Chancellor Olaf Scholz was just in town, and they didn't do that. right? They had a meeting where the White House was patting him on the back, like, great job providing all this funding. And it's true. Germany is now doing a good job bilaterally. Their military is still a disaster. And so when they throw shade at the French, well, at least the French can deploy forces in 24 hours and are ready to fight tonight. Well, the German military can't even deploy a brigade to a Baltic state. So there is a difference there that we are sort of could use our leverage to push Germany. And, oh, there's this guy, Mark Rutte, that wants to be NATO SecGen. That is, you know, essentially putting Euro ideology above Europe's defense. I would think that the United States would have some leverage there. Now, you know, especially him being a lame duck prime minister. And I think the third thing is that this is not unpopular at the EU level. This would not cause a populist backlash. And polling is demonstrating overwhelming support for increased EU defense initiatives. And you can tell that by the EPP, the European People's Party, Ursula von der Leyen's party, in the European parliamentary elections, now running on a larger EU budget for defense and EU defense commissioner. They see this as like a clear winning topic for them.
I'm curious, what's your sense for the reason behind the White House not pushing this more aggressively? Is this a lack of understanding of the dynamics at play at the EU level? Is it a lack of interest? Is it thinking that by, and similar to some other situations in the world, by just patting Olaf Scholz on the back, we'll just have done our duty and that's it?
I just don't think we think very much about what happens at Brussels and at the EU level and are not thinking about how we can actually make a positive impact in these discussions or an impact that benefits U.S. national security interests. If you think that it's in the U.S. national security interests for Europe, for the EU to conjure 100 billion euros to support Ukraine, which I think it is, regardless of whether that means U.S. companies could be included in that funding, then we should be encouraging it. And we have all this influence in Europe. I just think that it's the muscle memory has never been developed within the State Department of how to actually influence things at the EU level. And, you know, there's a bit of a transition that's happened within the White House staffing and other issues. So I just don't think it's front of mind on the agenda. We're so NATO focused that we miss these sort of opportunities to make a really positive engagement. I said that about when President Biden went to a European Council summit right after the invasion and that he could really push things forward by calling on the EU to actually borrow and invest in defense.
It might be a bandwidth issue, too.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot going on. And to get, you know, to get Jake Sullivan to understand how the U.S. could then impact this debate and whether the president should intervene. I mean, it's very hard work. And I there's a lot going on. And, you know, you really would have to make the case that there's a strategic intervention here. But look, I think the president got on the phone with Mark Rutte and was like, well, we think you should support this. I think that would make a huge difference. Let me also just say, and FT did some really good reporting on this, that the EU is looking at reinterpreting its legal interpretation of whether it can buy weapons or not. And this to me is like so stunningly obvious.
This is your hobby horse.
Yeah, this is my hobby. So I, you know, almost 2 years ago wrote a piece here at CSIS.
We had a whole conversation about which article in the treaty refers to this.
Yeah. And I, you know, I would have been told constantly by very, you know, EU officials very confidently, well, the EU is prohibited from buying weapons. And then I'd look at this Frontex border service that the EU has created, 10,000 strong, and they're flying drones and they have guns and they have like helicopters. I'm like, well, how can they buy stuff, but the EU can't buy things? And, you know, in the treaty, what it says in Article 41.2 of the Lisbon Treaty, it says that the European Union budget cannot find, quote, operations having military or defense implications. And as someone who spent a lot of my time when I was at the State Department reading through security assistance authorities of what we could and could not do, operations is a pretty clear term. So the EU cannot fund military operations. If you bought a tank, that tank is an inanimate object. It just sits there. If you were going to send it to war, then you have to allocate funding for that operation to use that tank, the fuel and other things like that. Buying a tank is not an operation. It's not a military operation. It's an object. So I don't see why the EU could not there's no legal reason I see why the EU could not simply borrow money and then buy stuff. And if it bought the stuff, it could then give that stuff either to member states. And then if it wanted to, you know, have EU tanks fighting the Russians, okay, then we have to have like a whole new treaty setup of what the EU could do. I actually think the EU could even buy certain military equipment like tanker fleets and operate them because it's not, it would operate those as, or maybe it transfers them to NATO, but it could operate them in peacetime and then NATO has them in wartime. I think there's all sorts of ways. There's this huge avenue here for the EU to actually do a lot when it comes to defense.
I see your point. I could also see potential detractors arguing that operations can be broadly understood as any second or third move that would take that tank and then put it even through either through a member state who sends it then to a war theater. Would that count as operations? And I think I'm more on your side at this point, but I'm just saying, I mean, that's an argument could that could be made.
Like, I didn't write the treaty, right? Like, they didn't need to include the word operations. They could say anything that fires something that could kill someone else, like anything that could be used for a defense or military defense, the EU is prohibited from buying. They could have explicitly said that. It explicitly does not say that. It says operations. So, I think you can have this incredibly large interpretation or narrow interpretation, whatever direction you want to go, that this prohibits the EU from, you know, doing anything. But then, you know, everything could be for defense, roads, right? So, you know, a road could be used for military purposes. So I think on that, and what the FT story said is the EU is going to look at basically getting its ducks in a row. So once this money comes through, that if this money ever comes available, that the EU could start allocating it. But maybe we should now, I think I've gone on enough.
That's okay.
I should also plug, I had a recent piece in Foreign Affairs that you can check out about the future of European defense and why it needs to become more Europeanized. And we could, there's a lot more there to discuss. But there was an election in Slovakia, not for the role that actually matters, but for one that I think sends a signal about where Slovakia is headed and what happened.
We're going to do a brief tour of three different places in Central and Eastern Europe. But yes, in Slovakia, the first round of the presidential election happened. And surprisingly, Ivan Korčok, who's the former Slovak foreign minister under the previous government, which was more pro-European, pro-democracy in general, won the first round. It's a pretty narrow win, but still important. Now, that means he's going into a runoff with Peter Pellegrini, who is a close ally of the prime minister, Robert Fico, who is, you could say, a populist. He was in power for years before in Slovakia and was known to have slowly degraded some of the checks and balances of the democratic state, and is trying to do that again. So in addition to also making somewhat pro-Russian statements and anti-Ukraine statements, like he's been pretty reluctant around Ukraine aid. Now we're set up for a runoff in this election, and it's going to be very close. What's important is about 11% of the vote in the first round went to a pro-Russian candidate. Those votes are likely to go to Pellegrini because of the position of the current government. We just talked to a Slovak official who actually thinks Korčok could pull it off. And it'll be very tight, but it's possible for him to get there. What's important there is just in the pursuit of balance to have the president be a voice that is more pro-European, more pro-Ukraine. And the previous president, Čaputová, was the same. And it was really important to have her there also to support domestically democratic institutions, not trying to break down the rule of law. Because we don't need, to be blunt, we don't need a second Hungary. So that'll be really important to look at. And that's why I think we should keep an eye on that. Also, because we need Slovakia on board for all of these votes that are happening in Brussels around Ukraine aid and any kind of big decision that's coming down.
There's a lot of concern about the direction of travel in Slovakia domestically along the lines that we've seen with Hungary, getting rid of the European prosecutor's office. And when you have two countries that can sort of ally, it means that the ability to do kind of an Article 7 against Hungary, which would require everyone but Hungary, well, Hungary has their kind of ace up their sleeve now in Slovakia.
And that's the situation we were in with Poland for years.
Yeah.
So nobody wants to go back there. Again, as you said, the president doesn't have a ton of power, but that balance is interesting. That balance is important.
And there's action in Bulgaria, too.
Yeah, unfortunately, again. So I'll try to make it as simple as possible. In short, Bulgaria is now staring down its potential sixth general election in 3 years, which is wild. Just imagining having to go to the polls that often with parties that are kind of always the same and then new ones emerging out of nowhere and then disappearing in the following election. So what happened in 2023 is after the fifth election, there was finally a coalition that was formed between some reformist forces in the political sphere who were tired of the somewhat pro-Russian party of GERB, G-E-R-B, and Boyko Borisov, who had been prime minister for years, tired of their attempts to also break down the rule of law, corruption, etc., but realized that instability needed to stop. So they agreed to a coalition with that party, and there would be a nine-month rotation for the prime minister. We just came up on that 9 month, and the rotation that was supposed to happen broke down. So Maria Gabriel, who was an EU commissioner, actually, was supposed to become the new prime minister. There's different theories coming from the different parties of why the talks broke down. The more reformist forces say that the GERB party tried to put forward new ministers without any kind of approval or discussion, some of whom would be somewhat problematic figures. They would try to replace the defense minister at a time where we really need stability in the Black Sea. So the talks broke down and there was no way to reform that coalition. So we're now staring at another general election. It's hard to tell where it's going to go. They're trying to make sure that it can be scheduled with the European election, because if you're asking Bulgarian citizens to go to the polls in early June for the European election, and then again, they will not go. And I think it's important to note from the European Council summit conclusions, there's a line on the importance of security and stability in the Black Sea region. And this is literally not that. So that's the last beat. And then
now on to another stable
incredibly
country.
Incredibly stable place, Bosnia. Bosnia and Herzegovina. Importantly, in the council meeting, the European Council meeting, there was the green light given to opening membership talks with Bosnia and Herzegovina, with the reminder that they still have to undertake more reforms before the actual talks can start. This is obviously a symbolic move, but some member states, I think it's important, really pushed for that to happen, to make sure that the Ukraine-Moldova track remains in parallel with the Western Balkans track, because this talk of enlargement, and I think those member states are right, there needs to be a tie-in. You can't say to member states to candidates who have been in the hopper for 10 years, like, well, you just take a back seat. We're actually going to push Ukraine and Moldova first, and then we'll go back to you. That's how you create more disillusion in those places towards the European Union, what it can do for you. But talk of enlargement is really difficult. So I think that was a good symbolic move, but it's not going to change a ton in practice.
Right. The key challenge in Bosnia is that the Dayton Peace Accords, which created peace, you know, froze in place essentially, the ethnic battle lines effectively. So there's a Serb, Republika Srpska. There's then a Croat and Muslim shared entity. And then this is all somehow supposed to work together at the kind of national level. Well, really, I think for Bosnia, the direction of travel in Serbia is really key because, you know, Bosnia having momentum toward peace is going to, or towards the EU is going to be really tough as long as Serbia is not making that same momentum. And of course, the Russia angle here with Dodik and the leader of the Republic of Srpska is going to be a problem.
Well, and credit where credit is due for its stability, Serbia, yes, Russia also. Other forces, though, in Croatia, the HDZ, which has its own version of the party in Bosnia and Herzegovina, is also pushing a very specific I don't want to say ethnic line, but a very specific line that is not necessarily collaborative in the institutions of Bosnia and Herzegovina. And we've seen a lot of like Turkish influence as well in Bosnia and the Muslim population. So there's a lot still that needs to be done. I think it's important, though, that the council sent this message and that the commission also said we should be doing this, and we will keep a close eye on the reforms that need to happen.
Yeah, no, the Western Balkans is now sort of this gray zone of stuck between competing geopolitical blocks, so to speak, with Turkey, with the EU, with Russia, and then China increasingly playing a role as well. But I think we're out of time. We'll leave it there. We'll now have go to our conversation with Jeff Ratke. We are thrilled to be joined by Jeff Ratke, president of the American German Institute, and perhaps more importantly, a former CSIS alum.
Proud to be both.
Yes. Prior to joining AGI, Jeff was a senior fellow and deputy director here at CSIS of the Euro program, where his work focused on transatlantic relations and U.S. security and defense policy. Jeff joined CSIS in 2015 from the State Department after a 24-year career as a foreign service officer dedicated primarily to U.S. relations with Europe. His assignment included being the director of the State Department Press Office from 2014 to 15, deputy chief of staff to the NATO Secretary General in Brussels, and minister counselor for political affairs in Berlin from 2006 to 2009. Jeff, welcome back to CSIS and welcome to the Eurofile podcast.
Delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
And fun fact, Jeff learned Latvian, which I've always thought was really impressive.
Okay, well, I'm going to be, there's a little modesty required there because my Latvian skills have atrophied.
It's okay, we won't do this entire interview in Latvian then. So why don't we start with Germany itself? Because our listeners may know that the Eurofile has a certain view of what's happening in Germany in the last couple years, which is that the coalition has had a lot of trouble making sense of itself. And that has shown through decisions that it's made, policies at the domestic level, and then obviously at the European level. But we'll talk about that in a little bit. What's your sense of the state of the coalition and Chancellor Scholz's leadership 2 years in?
Mm-hmm. Thanks. You know, there's a general fragmentation in politics in Europe, and you see it especially in parliamentary democracies that have proportional representation systems. Germany's no exception. In a way, Germany has been a little later to this game. If you look at countries like the Netherlands, Belgium, and a whole host of others where forming governments after elections has been really challenging and has required new types of alliances that in some cases defy logic and certainly defy history. So if you put it in that context, Germany is not really an exception. And after the last election, you have a coalition which you've never seen before, three parties. So that's unusual. And especially two of those parties, the Greens and the free market liberal FDP, have very different views about the role of the state in bringing about modernization. So nobody was under any illusions about the difficulties this coalition would encounter. In a way, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has pushed some of those disagreements into the background because you've had this overwhelming national effort to support Ukraine around which all the coalition parties, as well as the opposition CSU, have coalesced. But now you see when the practical business of governing comes around, real difficulties, and they are exacerbated by some constitutional restrictions. We may talk more about the so-called debt break and the limits that puts, but you know, more fundamentally, you have differing visions from the liberal FDP and the Greens and the SPD about how much government should be spending, what it should be spending it on, what kinds of incentives they should be setting. So there have been lots of bumps in the road. I still remain of the view that based on all the indications I'm aware of, this coalition is going to muddle through until the end of its legislative term, which is the autumn of next year. So they've got a year and a half, roughly, left to go. And the reason I think they will muddle through is mainly because all of these parties in the coalition face a worse fate right now if they were to try to hold an early election. Now, footnote. Holding an early election in Germany is not easy, much harder than in most other countries. We can talk more about why that might not even be possible, but that's a separate issue. But if you look at the polling, all of the parties in the coalition would do worse in the case of the Social Democrats and the FDP substantially worse. The FDP might not even make it into the parliament if they had an election. So the near-term difficulties are outweighed by the really serious risks they would face if they held an election right now. And then that brings me to the last point you raised, which is Chancellor Scholz's leadership. And I think what we see now, especially, is Olaf Scholz starting to position himself for re-election. And, you know, he was elected in 2021, or the Social Democrats finished first in that election, mainly because Scholz was the least bad option. Again, we can talk more about that, but, you know, he was not a front runner until the very end. And so the thing he has to do now is find a way to emphasize the positive aspects of his leadership and to unite enough voters behind him that they finish first again. And I think part of the way you see him doing that is a new dichotomy in German policy, especially with respect to Ukraine, which is, on the one hand, taking credit for Germany's significant contributions to Ukraine, but at the same time drawing sort of, you know, lines to say Germany will not become a party to the conflict. And not only that, that Germany will stop short of certain steps that could even make them look indirectly like they're part of the conflict. And so this sets up, I think, ground on which the Social Democrats believe they can benefit and win public support and confidence. They're not going to run an election on foreign policy, but this, I think, gives us a first indication of what that might start to look like.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about the Greens and how you see kind of their situation. There was a moment in the last election where it looked like Annalena Baerbock may actually, you know, win the election, and then her polling sort of went down and the Greens sort of settled into, a solid third place. But there was, I think, also a sense that they're perhaps a party on the rise with Robert Habeck, as well as the economy and environment minister, and Baerbock becoming the foreign minister. How are they faring? As you mentioned, how, you know, the SPD right now don't want to have an election, the FDP don't want to have an election. But it seems like the Greens, with the most proactive agenda, I would probably argue, internationally at the very least, in the European level, has sort of been squeezed the most by this coalition not wanting to be very active in some ways, or are blocking each other. And so it seems like they might have the most interest in just being like, to hell with this. What is their situation?
Interestingly, you're absolutely right, Max. There was a period in the last election campaign where the Greens were in first place. That broke down for a couple of reasons. I think part of it is they peaked early, and then the more scrutiny was applied in the election campaign, some things cropped up, including, you know, a sort of a plagiarism scandal and so forth. We won't go into all those details, but they peaked early and then finished third. Right now, if you look at the public opinion polls, the Greens are right about where they were. They're the one party in the coalition that has not suffered in the aggregate in terms of public support. But what you also see is they have not expanded their support. And indeed, although they are only the second largest party in the coalition, the opposition really sees the Greens as their intellectual opponent, as sort of the intellectual center of gravity. Whereas the Merkel years, in many cases, were about Merkel trying to build up a possible coalition option with the Greens, which then failed in 2017. Now you see the CDU and the CSU walking back from that. So that leaves uncertain what the coalition options for the Greens might be after the next election, if it's not going to be a continuation of this coalition.
Right. And that's sort of the Greens being at the sort of tip of the spear when it comes to climate policies and the green transition, and that resulting in a bit of a backlash now across Europe. But maybe then we could talk a little bit about the CDU, CSU, and also the AfD, because it seems, I mean, the way I sort of saw it is that at least in the early years of the coalition, I think you could say this is probably changing now, is that they're in some ways the four major traditional parties in Germany. So if you get rid of the AfD, we're all incumbent parties to some extent. It's sort of hard for the CDU to really run against the coalition when, you know, they were responsible for governing for the last 16 years. And you can look at the kind of Merkel era in a very positive light, but you could also say, look, you know, Nord Stream 2, low defense spending, getting rid of nuclear. Sure, that was a green idea, but the CDU ultimately implements it. You know, engagement, economic attachment to China, and all these pillars were sort of collapsing. So where do we find the kind of CDU, and how are they dealing with the kind of challenge that we're seeing across Europe in a center-right party seeing a far-right party emerge? And how are they kind of thinking about this dynamic?
So first of all, if you look at public opinion surveys, the CDU is far and away in first place right now. they have around 30% support, which would put them at least 10 points ahead of the second place finisher, which in this case would be the extreme right AfD. So on the one hand, they are profiting from the difficulties that the coalition has been facing. And in particular, you know, Germany's in an economic downturn right now. And so that allows, you know, the opposition the opportunity to highlight that and to say that they would, you know, do a better job. I mean, the first thing that's important is that the leader of the CDU and of the caucus in the Bundestag, which includes the Bavarian CSU, is Friedrich Merz, who was, you know, kind of famously the rival to Merkel for many years. So the fact that, you know, one of Merkel's strongest internal opponents is now the party leader provides a certain kind of a break with the past and allows him, at least personally, to argue that he would follow a different course and to, you know, not take too much responsibility for Merkel's governing record. The other thing that he has done fairly successfully is to unite his party behind him, because they were not terribly united at the end of Merkel's time in office. And so he has successfully carried that out. Now his challenge is to present a program for governing that is persuasive and can, you know, elevate them. I think they probably need at least to get 30%, if not more, to really have the chance to form a government. And that is mostly by creating a new platform, which they're just finalizing these days, which has some elements of social conservatism, but also at the same time maintaining, you know, what they call as their firewall to the far right. So, you know, they talk about the importance of integrating migrants and of having kind of a dominant or a lead culture. They're trying to soften that a little bit, but basically going back to sort of meat and potatoes conservative positions and without trying to adopt the language, the rhetoric, or the approach of the far right. The next litmus test of this is going to be in the fall and in the European Parliament elections first in June. And then in the fall, you have three states in eastern Germany where the AfD is particularly strong. And so those state elections, you could see the AfD finish first in one or more of them. And then we'll have another round of this, you know, kind of soul searching and reflection on whether the center right is successfully combating or doing its part to, you know, keep the extreme right support down.
So you mentioned Scholz is now positioning himself for re-election, which I think is visible in some of the comments that he's made, including just yesterday, and we're recording this on March 20th, where he made comments about accountability of EU institutions, for example. And I'd like to take us one level up to the EU, because obviously a lot of the domestic dynamics are weighing heavily on the decisions that both the coalition is making, but also the platform probably that the opposition will put forward. What's your sense of the role Germany has played under this coalition and under Chancellor Scholz in Brussels on the European level, because we've seen a range of things. So there's obviously a lot of support that's been given to Ukraine. I listened to your really great interview with Ambassador Michaelis, and his view is clear that Germany has been an incredibly important actor. It sounds to me, from what he says, second to the US in terms of providing support to Ukraine. But at the same time, we've seen a lot of reluctance on other files, you would say, at the EU level on more joint spending to actually increase defense capabilities at the European level, and a lot of other dynamics around the stability and growth pact. So how do you assess Germany's role on that stage?
Yeah. Well, thank you for referencing our podcast.
Yes, and I should say it is the Zeitgeist podcast.
And, you know, folks who want to hear more about the German official view and the ambassador's very cogent comments on that, by all means, have a listen. I think that from a strategic perspective, Olaf Scholz and this government have placed their biggest bet on the relationship with the United States and not at the European level. I think that's kind of obvious. It's not to say Germany is inactive within Europe, but, you know, if you look at the strategic questions, defense, security, there's been a doubling down on the relationship, including at the level of Olaf Scholz and President Biden. And I think if one were to criticize Germany, I think this is precisely where you would look, because Germany, as the largest economy, the most important power in the European Union, has an interest in European cohesion, has an interest in a way, hedging its bets. And I think it is underinvested in its European policy. There may be a variety of reasons for that, but I think you see it not least in Ukraine. I find it remarkable that Germany is the second largest supporter of Ukraine after the United States, but has not successfully set up structures within Europe in which it can take credit for and use its great efforts to elicit similar contributions of support and commitment from its European partners. Now, maybe the last meeting of the Weimar Triangle with President Macron of France and Prime Minister Tusk of Poland will put that on a slightly different path. I certainly hope so, but I think this is a real empty space, the way I look at it.
But do you think that's because of Scholz's leadership and his general approach to the EU, or is that something that's just more structural in Germany?
Well, I think it is not only Chancellor Scholz who has taken this course. You can look as well at the foreign ministry, at the finance ministry. You know, I think just in general, Germany's reactions, whether it is to the energy shock that came about as a result of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the cutoff of gas and oil largely, you know, that's been a national response. Germany mobilized 200 billion euros to deal with the domestic issues that arose from this. And, you know, some of its European partners were a bit unhappy about that because they argue that there's a European market for energy and there should be a European response. And, you know, they have a point. But on the other hand, a German government is going to get reelected based on its performance for its citizens. And so I think on a number of big issues, you see, at least right now, the German political system oriented toward making sure they've got the national solution right, rather than building new concepts of European concerted action.
I don't want to sort of overstate this, but I think there is sort of a growing sense in Europe that Germany's sort of going a bit rogue in some ways. Maybe rogue is probably the wrong word, but on the subsidies, for instance, I was just in Madrid, and the kind of level of kind of exasperation of being sort of continuously lectured by Northern Europeans about, you know, adhering to EU deficit rules, and you can argue those are legitimate, and adhering to EU rules, and then suddenly there's an energy shock, our companies need to be bailed out, and subsidies, which they've made it so that they're not sort of a technical violation, I think, of the EU, but it creates this big single market challenge if one country can then invest to sort of prop up its industries. You know, Germany doesn't have, it's, you know, energy resource poor, made bad bets, and is now, you know, using its fiscal space to pay for it. But that's sort of in some ways violating a lot of the spirit of the single market, because it gives its companies a competitive edge over others in Central or Southern or Eastern Europe. But it kind of hits at the broader question here of just Germany have a vision for where it wants to take Europe. And I think maybe we can now tie in the kind of the Taurus fight, the fight with Emmanuel Macron after he held a summit after the Munich Security Conference, which was, I think, intended to demonstrate, look, you know, Europeans joining together and it all is not lost, you know, after this very depressing Munich Security Conference. And instead, it sort of left the opposite image of like, man, Europe is really divided in this big fight between Scholz and Macron over Macron's talking about troops in Ukraine. Was that fight, I guess, just about those specific issues, or was it sort of pretending kind of a larger dispute over where Europe is headed?
There's a well-known saying in German politics that goes back to former Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, who liked to say, if you have visions, you should see a doctor. And, you know, it's not to say that German political leaders have never had a European vision. I think if you talk about Kohl, Mitterrand, yeah, and so forth, and all the diplomacy that surrounded European integration and the reunification of Germany, there are obvious examples to the contrary. But I think that Merkel for 16 years and Scholz for the last 2.5 years have followed a very, you know, what they might call pragmatic, practical approach that is not about articulating a grand European vision that Germany would then have to put its substantial resources behind. And by the way, you know, Max, you made the point about your talks in Madrid. I would just say that I think from a German perspective, people might say, look, you know, we're in a recession in this country. And it's not just a general issue, but if you look at the heart of the German economy, which is manufacturing, they're in really tough times. And if you look at energy intensive industries, the drop off in production has been dramatic. And so the debate inside Germany is about whether the government's policies have been insufficient, and whether in fact there is a deindustrialization of Germany happening, which gets at very, I use the word emotional not to downplay it, but very deeply seated national self-conception. And so I think that is perhaps not as well appreciated outside of Germany, but it's a real factor when you look at the German political dynamic. I may have only partially responded to your question, but I think when we look then at questions like support in Europe for Ukraine, in particular the military side and the disagreements with French President Macron, the German experience in security and defense policy, and especially its status as a frontline state during the Cold War, also come into that. So it's not just about European vision. It's also about the fact that Germany is not a nuclear weapons state, is dependent on the United States, especially, and to a lesser degree on France and Britain when it comes to nuclear deterrence. And so there's also an inherent caution in German security policy that leads to some of these disconnects that you've described.
I think there would perhaps be a bit more sympathy if Germany was then leading on a few other areas when it came to, you know, at the EU level. And this maybe gets to the economic question of, maybe we could talk just for a few minutes, we're running out of time, about the German economy and the constitutional decision around the debt brake, which then has limited German spending even more. What's the kind of current discussion there? This seems to be terrible for Europe and terrible for Germany economically, but I'm curious for your take on it.
Yeah, this is a central contradiction. On the one hand, this government took office under the headline of modernization, and it was the thing that conceptually united all the parties, that Germany had underinvested in its infrastructure, that digitalization needed to take priority, and also the green transition, which has been heavily impinged, of course, by Russia's aggression toward Ukraine, that these were things around which they could, you know, coalesce. It's turned out to be a lot harder than that, and especially because the fiscal space in Germany is limited by the constitutional limit on new borrowing. There are some in the Social Democratic Party and in the Green Party who might like to change that. I think if you talk to people in a quiet, sober mood, you might even find people in other parties who recognize that. But politically, I think that's going nowhere. I don't see any circumstances under which this government, the way it's constituted, will change the debt brake between now and the next election. So then it becomes a question of whether you have, does anybody want to campaign on that as an issue? It's not exactly a third rail issue, but it's close to one in German politics, because the accusation of fiscal imprudence in a demographically aging country that has real concerns about keeping its pension system solvent for the sorts of people who hope to enjoy a pension and who vote in high numbers, you know, this is a real thorny issue. And, you know, as much as one can see from the outside the difficulties that brings, nevertheless, it's right now intractable under a different coalition that might come together after the next election, depending on how the political forces align, then, you know, one might see.
And it feels like at the core, this drives so many decisions that Germany is making. Also, the positioning, the what some would probably call the lack of vision, maybe. But this is ultimately what they get elected on, as you said. So this is driving a lot of the thinking in Germany. And a lot of outside actors, I think probably President Macron, maybe some of us here in the U.S., look at this and say, but why won't Germany do things a different way, even in their approach to China? Maybe some voices calling for, you know, a little more business as usual with Russia. It's really important, sounds to me, for us to understand as observers that this drives so many dynamics in Germany, because, as you said, too, this is a visceral issue. Mm-hmm. Is this potential deindustrialization?
And I think Germans would also say, you know, government spending as a proportion of GDP in Germany is above 50%. You know, now you can question what they're spending their money on, and that's a discussion you can have. But what you don't find in Germany is the sense that they've got a lot of space. Maybe they do compared to France, which I think by OECD figures is spending 57% of GDP. That's government spending. But that's not where the public is, at least right now. Well, the last footnote I would add on that maybe is that the counterexample is the 100 billion euro defense fund that was passed by the government after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And that was written into the Constitution. In other words, it passed with a two-thirds majority, and it was supported by the opposition CDU-CSU. And I think that also begins to suggest, I don't think a revolution in the German approach to deficit spending, and certainly not in a European Union context, is on the horizon. But what you can see is that, you know, maybe when that 100 billion fund runs out, or maybe in other circumstances for different discrete purposes, you can see ways in which the political system might be willing to, you know, tinker with these rules, but not in the sense of abolishing it and going to a completely different system, I would say.
Well, Jeff, thank you for coming back to CSIS. It's been great to have you on the Eurofile.
Thanks so much for having me. Great talking with you.
That's it for today's episode. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. You may also be interested in our sister podcast, Russian Roulette, which covers the latest on Vladimir Putin's Russia and the ongoing war in Ukraine. Our thanks to our producer, Sean Falk, and to Otto Svensson for coordinating and researching this episode. We'll be back soon with another assessment of Europe through a Washington lens. Until next time.